Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I am joined by the expert on homeschooling, the man who wrote the book, literally, American Homeschooling, A History. Thank you, Dr. Milton Gaither, for taking some time out of your busy schedule to chat with me.
Thank you.
Now, I was able to get a hold of you through, actually, I don't know if it's a mutual friend, but someone recommended that I talk to you because in my research on Christian Reconstructionism, Dominion Theology, that's how I landed on your doorstep, because inevitably you can't get too far without coming across, obviously, R.J. Rush Dooney and his impact on Christian education and specifically Christian homeschooling. So I'm sure we're going to cover that in great detail. So thank you for your work. And, you know, the things that you've done on homeschooling have been super helpful. I've been reading through your blog, and there's some fantastic articles and resources on that as well, too. So now I know we're going to get to Dominionism, Christian Right, you know, all those great things, wonderful things about Rush Dooney and homeschooling, but you talk about the history of homeschooling. What is it about the story of homeschooling? I know your book, you kind of pick up with the American story. Could you kind of briefly walk us through the history of homeschooling, maybe from that point of view?
Sure. Let me explain to give some context for why I did that. I'm a historian of education by training. Mm-hmm. So I had finished a previous project and was ready for something new. And this was in about 2004, 2005. And homeschooling was, as it is now, it was a popular, interesting thing. And I was curious about it. So I started looking into the history, and there wasn't much published history on it. And what little there was often very, I would say, ahistorical, or sometimes people say Whiggish. We tend to kind of assume the present and read it back into the past. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to kind of correct for that. And I saw that, you know, no real scholar had really taken a hold of this topic. And it's a great topic of you know, wide interest. So that's why I did it. And here's the basic premise. There were a lot of people in early America who were teaching their children at home. Mm-hmm. That's not the same thing as what you see emerging in the 1970s in the United States and around the world. People who are aggressively anti-statist, trying to come up with an alternative to public education. These people in the early colonial period, they were just doing it because they had no other choice. You know, they had just arrived into what they took to be a wilderness. There weren't institutions there, and they, you know, did what nature required of them until they were able to, for the most, create institutions. So that's the story I tell at the beginning in the colonial period. I talk about colonial New England. I talk about mid-Atlantic colonies in the South. There was a lot of teaching at home. And then basically, as those regions of the country, well, there wasn't even a country at that point, as those colonies got more dense population, were able to build institutions, schools kind of started taking over those parental jobs. And it wasn't as if there was any kind of battle or parents didn't want that to happen. No, they were delighted. As soon as schools were made available, they rushed to send their children to schools. The subsequent story is, as Americans began to move westward, you see that same process happening over and over again. The frontier, at the beginning, there's nobody there. And so you brought your kids, you got to teach them yourself. And then gradually you get a few friends and more people. And then there are enough families to build a schoolhouse. And that's one of the first things they do when they can. And eventually you get public schools there too. So that's the basic story of American education into the 19th and 20th century. Home education being done by necessity, being gradually replaced by institutional schooling of one sort or another.
It seems to me that there, I don't know what you think about this, but there's some maybe attempts to revise history, a little bit of revisionist history going on, because some of the more Christian extreme homeschooling websites and articles that I've read, their take on Christian homeschooling is they view that period almost like this golden age of homeschooling that we need to return to. You see, They all did it by, you know, they were Christians, they were this Christian nationalist story. And it was a wonderful time, a golden age where parents raised their children, taught them in the ways of God and all the rest of it at home. Is that a kind of a narrative that you hear in the modern homeschooling movement?
Certainly. And it's not unique to homeschooling. I mean, that's a classic Americana trope, mm-hmm. Kind of nostalgia for the good old days on the frontier, you know, when, mm-hmm. when Americans were pure, when the air was clean and everybody was virtuous, you know, that yeah. sort of thing. That appeals to, you know, a lot of conservative white Protestants. That same narrative does not appeal to African Americans, Native Americans, and many others who remember mm-hmm. those days very differently, right? For a certain part of the population, there is tremendous nostalgia for those days. If we get into the 1970s, we'll probably talk about this more, but mm-hmm. you recall that in the 1970s, it wasn't just conservative religious people who were interested in restoring that. There were a lot of people on the left who did the same thing. They rejected mm-hmm. modern society too, and started going out to the woods and forming communes and living off the land and everything. And it's hard living, you know?
It is.
A lot of people who tried that, after a few years, they kind of snuck back into the mainstream. Because it's not as easy as it sounds to go out mm-hmm. there on the frontier and live wild and free.
Mm-hmm. Homesteading is not easy.
No, it's not at all.
So are we saying there's really a distinction between the modern era of homeschooling? When did you say that begins? Kind of in the 1970s and versus the colonial era and into the 19th century?
Sure. To reiterate the thesis of the book, basically, a lot of these, what you were saying, these more conservative sites you've read, kind of valorizing this early period, mm-hmm. often mistake just category errors, taking the way we think today and imposing it back on the past. And again, you see it not only in homeschooling. If you're familiar with the school choice movement in America, there's a lot of advocacy for privatizing public education. And mm-hmm. advocates for that will say, with justice, in America in the early 19th century, we didn't have public schools. It was school choice. And they're sort of right. We had we had schools that were publicly and privately financed, a massive organization of charter schools all over the place. Academies were rampant. So there's something to that argument. But when you call it school choice, you're taking a 21st century way of thinking and sticking it back into a time period where that doesn't quite fit. Mm-hmm. And so that's the same thing here. Yes. There were a lot of conservative Christian people in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries in the United States, or in the American colonies, and then later in the United States, who were teaching their children at home. Were they self-consciously doing that as homeschoolers? No. And again, the evidence for that is as soon as schools became available, they took advantage of
it. Yeah, it wasn't an alternative to state education, as it were, as we think of it today, as you say, public schools versus homeschooling or private schools. They didn't have the school choice. It was correct. Teach your kids at home or they learn nothing, it sounds like, of necessity. But then in the modern era...
There are a couple of exceptions to that. Mm-hmm. There's always been a kind of a quiet American aristocracy, some very wealthy Americans, who some of them early on, including some of the parents of the founding fathers, you know, these were often families of means living on a plantation or something like that, and they did the European style. If you read John Locke, John Locke mm-hmm. has negative things to say about schools. He thinks it's much better for a child to be tutored in the home so as not to pick up bad habits from, you know, ne'er-do-well children. And a lot of American wealthy people did that. They had to add home tutors and things like that. That's an alternative. That's real. That was there. Mm-hmm. And there have been a few individuals whose families, for one reason or other, rejected schools, and in isolated cases where they'll homeschool. A famous example that people often talk about is Thomas Edison, whose mother mm-hmm. was frustrated with her son's schooling, brought him out, let him tinker around, and you know the results of that.
So. Mm-hmm. It seems like, there was a big push to institute colleges and universities right away. I remember I studied the work of Jonathan Edwards for my doctoral dissertation, and you know, he was a student. I think he went to Yale, I think. I'm trying to remember now. But, you know, it was one of the very first institutions of higher education. They were really keen to establish colleges, universities. So it wasn't that they were trying to rebel against the state. They were trying to, importance of education, certainly
right.
along the European lines, didn't they?
That's right. The Puritans, you know, who settled in Massachusetts Bay, 1632 mm-hmm. or something like that. And then by 1636, they found Harvard, you know.
Exactly. Boston, the first, exactly.
Year. Yeah.
Right off the bat. It wasn't like they were saying, finally, we've escaped from the tyranny of the European monarchies and all that, so we can homeschool our kids forever. They're starting colleges and universities, and they see it as a thing of importance. But now in the modern era, it seems like, does it pick up in kind of the 1970s? I mean, talking about, I read in a chapter in your book, you talk about some of the impacts on society. You've got post-World War II, the Cold War. There's a lot of upheaval. The automobile, suburbanization, women's rights, the nuclear families changing, counterculture revolution. Then there's this movement of people going out, like you said, hippies, starting communes out in the woods. Is that sort of the genesis of what we see the modern homeschooling movement?
Right. And that's what I needed to do. In the book, if I was going to make that claim, like I just told you about, where early people who were teaching their kids at home, they weren't self-consciously homeschoolers. And then later they were. Well, what happened? What changed? Mm. Something happened because Americans of all stripes, conservative, liberal, moderate, had been pretty staunch supporters of public education for the most part into the mid-20th century, into the early 1960s, and then all of a sudden everything falls apart. Why? And so some of those things you just described are why. So I have a chapter in the book called Why Homeschooling Happened that explains some of the broad social cultural changes in America. And they're familiar territory for people who are conversant with this part of American history. Mm-hmm. The fragmentation of the post-war consensus in America, as you mentioned, suburbanization, changing roles for women, changes in family structure, all sorts of things. Coalesced, contributed to a situation such that, and this is what's so interesting about it. This is what made me first interested in the history of homeschooling. When I first started looking into this, I figured out, I saw early on, that people on the radical left and people on the radical right at about the same time made the same move. Mm-hmm. Both of them, neither group had objected to public education much in the previous years, but then about the same time in American history, both on the left and on the right, a substantial group of people say, whoa, these schools are terrible. And they had opposite reasons for thinking the schools were terrible, but the solution was the same. We need to reject institutional schooling and return to the home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's two correctives right there that we've just identified in your book. One is the narrative of the American colonial era up to the 19th century doesn't support that sort of mythical revisionist history of this golden age of homeschooling. And then second, there were a lot of people who rejected public schools for completely non-religious reasons. So it's not, again, a narrative that it was just a Christian thing, people withdrawing because of, you know, the arguments of guys like Rush Dooney and others who were saying, oh, that's what the problem with America today is, the fact that these kids have been raised in a humanist institution and all the rest of it. We're going to get to that, I'm sure. But it seems like there was tensions, though, between some of these early homeschool pioneers. Again, talking in general terms, between some of the state boards of education. And surely that was an inevitability, wasn't it, that you've got these parents going off, starting communes and withdrawing from society. At some point, the state boards of education are going to get involved. They're going to say, now, wait a minute, do the parents actually have academic credentials to be able to teach their kids? It seems like that's one of the things that was an early issue with homeschoolers.
That's correct. The legal history of homeschooling is very important, and I spend a lot of time on that in the book. And it's one of the reasons when people on the left and the right started teaching their kids at home, at first they worked together because they had a common enemy. And as you said, they were, in some cases, you know, actually persecuted, in many cases, at least harassed. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because back in the early 20th century, started in the late 19th century, but a little after World War I, every state in the country had passed a compulsory school law, state after state after state. Now, each state has its own law, and each law is its own thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're a homeschooler, and it's now 1977, and you want to pull your kid, it's really confusing to know what's legal or not, because it's a state law. These laws were written 100 years ago or, you know, 75 years ago, and they didn't really think about this issue, so they don't really have much to say about it. Is it okay for us to do that? And in many cases, it wasn't clear at all, and so that meant that it was up to the local school districts to make the decision, and it was totally random, depending upon the point of view of your particular school administrator, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, in one town, things would be fine, and next door, there'd be persecution of homeschooling families. And because of that, you had all kinds of truancy charges and court cases that were all over the place. So these pioneers you mentioned a minute ago, a lot of the time they spent was going around giving, often for free, defending homeschoolers in courts. Mm-hmm. And the long-term result of that, to generalize, you know, about 20 years of history, is that over time, pretty much all the states in America, not all of them, but most of them, dramatically revised their public education statutes, their compulsory school laws, to make it more clear that homeschooling was legal and fairly easy to do. And that has continued to be the case as we've moved on subsequently in history. It's continued to get easier and easier and easier almost everywhere for homeschooling to be done, with less and less oversight.
They've won those legal battles in the main, it seems like. You talk about in your book, you mentioned the word pioneers. You say there's kind of three homeschooling pioneers. You talk about John Holt, Raymond Moore, and of course our infamous R.J. Rush Dooney, the father of Christian Reconstructionism. But, you know, it's interesting, as I'm reading these Christian homeschooling history websites, they might mention Holt in passing. They talk a little bit about Raymond Moore. They don't mention Rush Dooney at all.
Right.
And so this is interesting. Again, I think there's a bit of, I don't know if it's revisionist history. What about the impact of these guys, Holt, Moore, and of course Rush Dooney, which we'll get to, but Holt is kind of one of the early pioneers in the movement. Again, not necessarily for religious reasons.
Right. Yeah. Not for religious reasons. Holt is very, it's fascinating that he was the leader. I mean, he was the leader of the movement at the beginning. He had never married, never had children. Earlier in his career was an advocate of child rights and things that the conservatives would really not like at all. He didn't even seem much interested in the family. He was much more interested in, you know, he was kind of, you know, a hippie. And then what he did is he started going to private, teaching in free schools, free private schools, and was interested in that for a while, and wrote some books in the early 1960s that critiqued public education. These were tremendous bestsellers. He was very popular. He was one of the most popular critics of American public education in the early 1960s, several best-selling books. All right. He gets more and more disillusioned with the free school movement and eventually decides we don't need schools at all. And then he discovers homeschooling. Like, whoa, interesting. And so he begins to, because he's got some money, he's been making royalties from all these books he's been selling. So he starts putting together these isolated families who didn't even know, they thought they were the only ones who are doing it. And he publishes the first ever homeschooling newsletter in 1977, and it goes from there. And so, yeah, Holt brings the movement into prominence for the first time. He shows up on the Phil Donahue show. That was a major moment in the history of homeschooling, where most people had never heard of it. And then here's this guy named John Holt. Oh yeah, I remember Holt. I bought his book 10 years ago, right? Now he's talking about homeschooling. What is that? And Holt becomes the celebrity who makes the movement possible, and he sacrifices a lot. He get, you know, basically it's his own money that's underwriting a lot of the early stuff. So yeah, but yeah, he's not religious, doesn't even have kids, you know, so it's just not the same sort of thing that a conservative Christian would want. An important point to note when we're talking about the people on the left and the right, in terms of percentages, nobody knows a precise number, but there just have always been way, way, way more religious conservatives than people on the left. And the people on the left who homeschool typically don't do it for quite so long, and they typically don't have as many children as the conservatives often have. So when you had Holt being the figurehead of the movement, that looked good in the press. He was great on Donahue, but that led to kind of rising, fomenting unrest among the people for whom he was speaking who didn't share his assumptions about reality, right? Do you want me to go on to the other two?
Well, I was just going to say, when we're on the subject of Holt, you make the point in the book that one of the things he did was he, at some point, as this movement started getting off the ground, he started talking to the conservative Christian side, and that this is one of the things that maybe you can comment on that, that I don't know if he climbed in bed with the guys on the right or what, but
in that first newsletter, he said, you know, I've been looking into this, and it seems to me that one group that seems to know a lot more, because he's trying to figure out, like, we're figuring out how we can make this legal, how we can do this okay without getting persecuted by the government. Well, look, I've learned that these people, they're called the Seventh-day Adventists, and they seem to have been doing this for a long time. We need to get to know these people and figure, they may know stuff we don't know. So that, yeah, he was definitely a big tent guy, totally willing. If you make common cause with me, I'm against institutional schools. If you believe in that, you're on my team. We're all one big family. So his spirit was able to hold that together.
Yeah. So you got Holt, he's the father of this unschooling movement. Then you've got Raymond Moore, the second homeschooling pioneer. Again, he founds the Moore Foundation. He's got this Moore formula. What was the contribution of Raymond Moore, would you say?
Yeah, well, it started with his wife, Dorothy. Both of them were education majors way back in the 1930s. And they were Seventh-day Adventists. The Adventist church was a group called the Millerites. They have very interesting end times ideas. Ellen White was the kind of figurehead that started that movement. And White wrote a lot about child rearing, education, things like that. And Ellen G. White firmly believed that children shouldn't be in school until age 8 or 10. It's too early to get them any sooner than that. And then she wanted them, instead of having this rigorous, you know, worksheet driven kind of memorize things, she thought children should learn best in nature and experiential learning. So it views that a lot of people these days call progressive, you know, then this is baked into her way of thinking back in the 19th century. So Dorothy Moore, who has been saturated in Ellen G. White, she's talking about that, and then she starts having children, and is increasingly frustrated, even as her husband is working his way up the ranks of the Adventist and then later the public school sector. And basically, Raymond in his eventual role as a researcher, adopts Dorothy's point of view. And because he gets some money from various foundations and some support, including a major federal grant, he does all this research, concluding that basically, without saying it like this, Ellen G. White was right all along, and early education is bad for kids. And so he starts preaching that over and over and over in academic settings, in the congressional record, to any court he'll hear him. And eventually he writes a book about it, and then he's invited by James Dobson to come on to Focus on the Family.
That's the connection.
That's the connection.
There's the religious right there.
That's right. So now, like I said, with the appearances on the Donahue Show for Holt, that's what kind of brought it into the mainstream. Well, this is what brought it into the Christian mainstream. In 1980, most conservative Christians were not homeschooling. That wasn't on the radar. What they were doing, they were primed for it, though. They were increasingly frustrated. If you recall, I mean, this is a history that needs to be understood. The public schools in America had reflected that kind of evangelical Protestant point of view from the beginning. And that began to change over the 20th century, and it changed symbolically in a major way in the 1960s through two Supreme Court cases, the 62 and 63 case, one of them outlawing school-sponsored prayer, and the next one outlawing school-sponsored Bible reading, devotional Bible reading, which this shocked a lot of Christian conservatives. And at first, they tried to fight those things with constitutional amendments or something to override those Supreme Court decisions, and that failed. And then secondly, well, if we can't triumph and kind of impose our will in the public schools, we'll separate out and create private Christian schools, which conservative Christians were doing in the 60s and 70s for the most part. By 1980, a lot of those schools were struggling. It's hard to do a Christian school, you know. So when Moore came along and Dobson interviewed him and he starts talking about teaching your kids at home, a lot of conservative Christians were like, hey, that's a great idea. So Dobson brought him in 80, he brought him back in 82 and kept bringing him back because he was the most popular guest Dobson had. Letters would come out. And all the people who came after, not all, but lots and lots and lots of conservative Christians who came after, they first heard about homeschooling through those Dobson interviews with Raymond. Mm-hmm.
So Moore is important from the point of view that his appearances on Focus on the Family that opened him up to this huge Christian audience, conservative Christian audience. I mean, as a kid, I grew up in an evangelical church in the Seattle area. We listened to Focus on the Family. I probably heard those episodes with Raymond Moore on it. I didn't go to a homeschooling. I wasn't homeschooled, but I went to a very small Christian school. So my parents were part of that movement that I've seen now as part of this bigger picture of Reconstructionism and all these other pieces to it. Okay, so we've talked about two of the three pioneers. We've got John Holt, now Raymond Moore. Now we get to R.J. Rush Dooney, father of Christian Reconstructionism. What is his role in this whole story of homeschooling?
Right. Yeah, his role is very important, influential, although, as you noted earlier, seldom acknowledged. And there's a good reason for that. And if you've read McVicker's book or you've had him on your show, McVicker explains this very well. A lot of people who have been deeply influenced by Rush Dooney don't want to let that be known because Rush Dooney's politics were very alarmist. They were pretty extreme, you know.
Pretty extreme.
So for Rush Dooney, you don't really talk so much only about his kind of he never had a breakout moment like the two we've just talked about. He never had a Donahue special.
He was on Bill Moyers though in 1987. I think he garnered more shock than anything else because he advocated the death penalty for homosexuals and incorrigible teens, and people were like, whoa, who is this guy?
Right.
Never heard of him.
So here's the deal. Rush Dooney was a very intellectual, a brilliant man. He read a lot. So when you read his stuff, I mean, it's thick. It's intellectual stuff. It's not like most of the stuff you get at a Christian bookstore. So what happens is a lot of people who are more popularizers, they will read Rush Dooney and the mind that he had, and they'll simplify it to a great degree and water it down and publish it as their own stuff. And they will not, certainly have not cited him in their footnotes, and sometimes they do, but they often don't because it's because of what you just said. It's an embarrassment.
Rare. We are going to be right back in just a minute with the second half of this chat with Dr. Milton Gaither. We're going to pick back up this thread of the influence of R.J. Rushdoony and Christian Reconstructionism, specifically on Christian education and the homeschooling movement. I just wanted to take a minute to give a quick shout out to the people who have decided to support this show on Patreon. I wanted to give a thank you to Sandra Bandman, Sandy Eastman, Liam Moore, Danny Kent, and Ray Guilford. Thank you all for your support of Mindshift Podcast. What are the benefits to being a patron of this show? Well, for one thing, you get early access. The episodes drop on Wednesdays, and you get those on Patreon, as well as you get to be a part of our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group, and we do all kinds of stuff. One of the things we do is our monthly Zoom call, and I like to have people who have been on the show come back. We had Laura Anderson on last month. That was a fantastic conversation, talking about how to forgive people who have caused us religious trauma, both in the past and currently. This month, we're going to have David from The Graceful Atheist. In fact, that episode just dropped a little bit ago, if you haven't heard that yet. So David is dropping in on the 28th of this month. So if you want to be a part of that Zoom call, you can participate by helping to support this show financially. I was going to say, too, that when this episode drops, we'll be a little bit more than halfway through my online course, Tracing the Origins of the Christian Right and Dominion Theology. We will have covered about 3 episodes out of 5. This has been a fantastic course. I've really enjoyed it going through it. The first episode was on the rise, the origins of the Christian right. Second one, we talked about R.J. Rushdoony, his story, the influences on his development of Christian Reconstructionism. Then we're going to get into Dominion Theology, Christian Nationalism, homeschooling. And basically what we're doing is we're tying what seems like a bunch of loose threads together into sort of a coherent picture. So hopefully we'll be doing that course again if you're interested. You can always follow me on Twitter, send me a DM if you have any thoughts or ideas on that at MindShift2018. Now, before we get back to the chat with Milton Gaither, I wanted to mention really quickly what is coming up in the next few episodes here on MindShift Podcast. I've got a call scheduled this week with Rob Boston from the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. We're going to be talking more about all of his work on Christian Reconstructionism, Dominion Theology, Christian Nationalism, the Christian Right. Rob is an amazing resource, so I'm looking forward to chatting with him. I've also got a scheduled interview with Kristen Cobes-Dumez. She has written the excellent book Jesus and John Wayne, talking about masculinity, muscular Christianity, toxic biblical patriarchy, and how that is affected and infected both evangelicalism and the Christian right. And I'm also chasing up Dr. Michael McVicker to have that chat on his book on R.J. Rushdoony and Christian Reconstructionism. I've also got a scheduled interview, hopefully within the next couple of weeks, with Julie Ann from the Spiritual Sounding Board blog. And she is an expert on the Quiverful movement, having come out of that herself. So picking up on some of the stuff that Dr. Gaither and I are going to be getting into toward the second half of this episode. So again, as always, excellent content headed your way. Stay tuned for Rob Boston, for Kristen Cobes-Dumez, for Julie Ann, and I'm sure there's going to be some more recordings between now and then. So stay tuned for that. All right, let's get back into the chat with Dr. Milton Gaither as we continue this piece on Reconstructionism, the impact of R.J. Rushdoony on not just Christian education, but specifically Christian homeschooling and how that has developed into the movement that we see today.
So here's the basic point of view, and this is why Rushdoony is important. The fundamental thing to understand about conservative Christian homeschooling and conservative Christians in America in general, conservative Protestants, is that they are committed to the idea that the Bible is the Word of God, right? Mm-hmm. The Bible is the truth. Why is that? Because this comes out of the fundamentalist modernist controversies of the late 19th century. If mm-hmm. your readers or listeners are familiar with that, when Darwinism and historical critical approach to the Bible hit in the United States, it led to a fragmentation of American Protestantism into modernist folks who, this is the simplified version, but basically the case, modernists who kind of were like, oh, you know, we can harmonize Darwinism with Genesis. Or modernists were like, yeah, okay, so the Bible was written hundreds of thousands of years ago, and, you know, we don't need to, not everything necessarily applies to today, versus fundamentalists who said, no, if the Bible is not what it is, if it's not the Word of God, then we don't really have a faith anymore. And so what we're talking about now comes out of that fundamentalist stuff. So the fundamentalists were already primed for the idea that the Bible is the Word of God. They did not have the same particular interpretation of that that Rushdoony had for the most part. And that's where you get a lot of confusion. And I will get there in a minute. But let me lay out Rushdoony's point of view. Mm-hmm. Rushdoony shared with American fundamentalism the idea that the Bible is the word of God. Biblical presuppositionalism, he calls it, right?
Oh, yeah.
You start with the presupposition that the Bible is the word of God.
Cornelius Van Til. Yeah, basically.
This is not something we can argue. You either believe it or you don't.
Yeah.
Now, if you take me on that, if you accept that the Bible is the word of God, let me see where I can take you next. And he has three things he wants to say about the things that connect with homeschooling.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is that he thinks, and here's where he's a little bit different than a lot of fundamentalists, he thinks that both the Old Testament and the New Testament are written for us, for the church, and they are meant mm-hmm. to be a template for how the Christian society should be organized.
Mm-hmm.
Some people call this Calvin's third use of the law. The Old Testament is kind of a how-to for how the Christian society will organize itself. And that's where you get the radical stuff that he says.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stoning homosexuals and disobedient children. What? He didn't just make that up. That's right there in the Bible. You know,
that's what
God told the Jews to do. And if God tells us that, who are we to tell God that, oh, no, that doesn't apply. God said it. We should do it. All right.
What's so interesting, I was going to say, interject a minute there. What's interesting about it, it shows that he is a biblical literalist, I think. What your point is exactly taken. For example, if you listen to that Bill Moyers interview in 1987, Moyers presses him on that point. Says, are you actually saying that we should have the death penalty for homosexuality? And he says, I don't believe it. I didn't say it. God said it. I'm only following the Bible.
That's right.
You know, don't blame me. Blame God, essentially. Right. But I have to do what it says in the text. So he's a biblical literalist right down the line.
That's right. Okay, so that's point number one, that, mm-hmm. that presuppositionalism, which leads you to the idea that the Bible gives you a template for how to organize Christian societies today.
Mm-hmm.
All right, point number two, Rushdoony had a very interesting understanding of American history because he's a Calvinist. And that's important to note here because of several factors that I can get into if you want. But basically, Calvinism was very powerful in colonial New England, but it did not become the dominant American Christianity. It wasn't the dominant Protestant ethos. The dominant mm-hmm. ethos was more Methodist, Baptist, Arminian. Rushdoony's a Calvinist, so he's looking back to the early Puritans. And he thinks, and correctly, that they came over here because they wanted to establish a new Jerusalem, right? The old England had fallen apart. Cromwell's mm-hmm. revolution didn't work out. Come over here and let's try again. And we're going to show old England how to really organize a Christian society. So he thinks that God had chosen these people to move them into this new world. He's basically taking what they believed and saying they were right about this. Mm-hmm. And somehow along the way, things got derailed. But the original founding vision of America was not to create this constitution where you separate church from state and all this kind of mm-hmm. stuff. That came later, and that was the Enlightenment messing up everything. The original divine mission that God had established for this place was to have true Christianity flourish and shine as a light to the rest of the world. And see, Rushdoony, he is what's called a postmillennialist. He believes mm-hmm. that it is inevitable. It is going to happen that Christianity is eventually going to take over the world. Christ will not return until the Christians dominate mm-hmm. everybody. That's going to happen. It's not like Rushdoony hopes that's going to happen. It's sort of like Marx and communism. I'm just telling you it's what's going to happen. It's just the law of history. That's
inevitability.
The law of history. It is inevitable that Christianity is going to take over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Rushdoony thinks that the United States was divinely chosen to play a role in that process, as witnessed by its Christian founding by the Puritans. So mm-hmm. that notion of America's providentialist history, that we were given a special mission, a vocation by God, that has lived on and has been very powerful in current thinking among many.
Oh, yeah, that covenant theology.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're still seeing it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we got one more to go. Number three is sphere sovereignty. The idea here is that if you read the Bible right, you see that God has the family,
mm-hmm.
the church, and the government. And these are separate spheres. And the mm-hmm. government's job is not to tell the family what to do or to tell the church what to do. It needs to stay in its own sphere. And if there's a hierarchy, the family's up at the top. The family should be, he has this whole biblical model in his mind, a biblical model of the family. It's headed by a patriarch, large family. And the father is the ruler, reflecting the divinely ordered hierarchy of God. So that's what the family should be set up like. The church should be set up similarly, and the state over here doing its thing. Servant to the others, not telling the others what to do. So mm-hmm. his fundamental kind of political effort is to try to free the family from oversight by the church. I mean, sorry, by the state. And mm-hmm. that's where he's interested into the homeschooling
That's the key thing. You say in the book, those are the two major contributions that Rush Dooney had, was on the one hand, the Reconstructionist piece, which you've just articulated very well, better than I could, even though I've been studying Rush Dooney for a long time now, but you laid it all out really beautifully, the whole theonomy and the return to Christian law, taking dominion and all the rest of it. Then the other aspect, though, is the establishment of this kind of legal infrastructure. That was another aspect of his contribution. I know he was a tireless advocate. He went all over the country. He spoke in churches and home groups and seminaries, Bible, anyone that would give him an audience, he would speak. And on that subject of, you need to get your kids out of the state school, statist schools, he would say. And he was an advocate for Christian schooling and then homeschooling. But he was an advocate in a lot of legal court cases too.
Right.
And that was an important component, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think McVicker found 27 cases at least. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones he was able to find.
Yeah, that we know of.
Free. Yeah.
So then off the back of Rush Dooney's efforts, you get foundations like the HSLDA. So you've got,
okay, right.
Yeah. This is a whole nother movement. Now we're moving into the sort of post-Rush Dooney era now. After he's gone, what happens in the homeschooling movement?
Right. So let's talk about some of the influences. Like you mentioned earlier, a lot of influences, but nobody really talks about it. So let me run through some of the main ones. Let's start with Paul Lindstrom. Christian Liberty Academy, a private school started by Paul Lindstrom. He was a card-carrying Reconstructionist. I mean, the real deal, full throttle, right? He created ACE, Accelerated Christian Education. It was one of the first curricula that became popular among homeschoolers.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It wasn't a little bit popular. It was popular.
Huge,
I wrote down
yeah.
my numbers in the book. Let's see if I find it.
Yeah, I had a friend that went to an ACE school out of Missoula, Montana. He left our small Christian school. They moved to Missoula, at which point he became a student in this ACE Academy. So, yeah, that was in the mid-80s. So, going
right
back.
Yeah, I've got it from the book. 21,000 homeschoolers were using his curriculum by 1985. 21,000. Yeah. At the high point in 1998, it was 35,000. So,
wow.
That's a lot of people. And again, that's this is not sort of vanilla Christian curriculum. This is Reconstructionist curriculum. They had Gary North. They had Rush Dooney on the curriculum, on the syllabus. You know, people were reading that stuff. So that's one. Now, Lindstrom gets in trouble in many states through homeschooling and some of his schools, and he hires a bunch of lawyers to help him out, and they win most of the cases that they have. Let me give you a list of the lawyers this Reconstructionist guy hired. Number one, John Whitehead. John Whitehead founded the Rutherford Institute. Whitehead had been a hippie. He got saved reading Hal Lindstrom's Late Great Planet Earth and became a Reconstructionist. He had been a Marxist. And so when he starts listening to Rush Dooney, it's like Marxism. It's like a Christian political.
Christianized.
That's what he was looking for. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was an associate of Rush Dooney. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, now he was the real thing. Rush Dooney helped found the Rutherford Institute. He was on the board. Amundsen, Howard Amundsen, who financed the Chalcedon Institute that Rush Dooney ran. Amundsen founded, he financed Rutherford too. So he wasn't just a little bit influenced by Rush Dooney. He was Rush Dooneyan, you know?
Right. They're in the same circle.
Yeah. Whitehead's first book, Rush Dooney wrote the preface and outlined what the book should look like.
Right.
You know? Yeah, it was. Yeah. He was the real
very
thing.
Close.
Now he moved on. Now another lawyer that Lindstrom hired was Michael Ferris, who went on to found a Homeschool Legal Defense Association. In a minute, I'll explain that he's not exactly a Reconstructionist, and I'll talk about how that fundamentalist and Reconstructionist stuff needs to be understood, so we don't kind of blankly ascribe Reconstructionism to everybody. But just know that he's in the ballpark. William Ball was another who was influential in many early cases, and David Gibbs, who worked with a lot of cases in homeschooling related and also related to sexual harassment issues and which you get into differently. And David's son is still active in the movement. But anyway, so a lot of the lawyers who went on to be major players in conservative Christian legal activism, you know, Lindstrom took care of. Okay, let's keep moving. Mary Pride. Mary Pride was a major figure in the homeschooling movement in the 80s and 90s, which similar story with Whitehead. She converted to Christianity, went hardcore Calvinist, went to an Orthodox Presbyterian church, and you know was influenced largely by Francis Schaeffer and his wife Edith. Francis Schaeffer is a good example of what we were talking about a minute ago, somebody who talked with a more mainstream accent than Rush Dooney, drew a lot on Rush Dooney's ideas, but kind of in a more soft way. He was like, soft Reconstructionism. He wants biblical society, biblical values, but he's not going to say the stuff that Rush Dooney said in terms of how hardcore he would make it be. But yeah, it's the same basic Calvinism creating a Christian alternative to secular humanism.
So, well, and I know, I was going to say, just to, I remember reading in Mick Vickers' book that I think at one point Rush Dooney kind of accused Schaefer of ripping off his ideas, not giving him credit for it, saying, but hey, I did. That's my stuff.
Yeah,
but you didn't footnote me. You didn't reference me talking about a biblical worldview and a Christian worldview and these other things. That was, a lot of that was in Rush Dooney's earlier stuff.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, if you hear anybody say secular humanism, that's Rush Dooney. That's the idea that secular humanism is this religion that's challenging Christianity. Rush Dooney, you know, he wrote the book on that. That's his thing.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Keeping on going. Many listeners would probably have heard of Bill Gothard.
I was raised in it.
Okay. See, now, what's interesting about Gothard, like Rush Dooney, is different than mainstream fundamentalism because he also believes that the Old Testament is operative today. And a lot of the eccentric things that Gothard advocated, you know, over the course of his career during his seminars drew on his interpretation of the Old Testament and trying to apply it to today.
Mm-hmm.
And similar kind of things going on there. Okay, let me keep going a little bit more. I only got one more to talk about. Chris Klicka, who was one of the early lawyers in the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Ferris hired him as soon as Michael Ferris, who's founded the organization, hired Chris Klicka when he figured out that Klicka knew about homeschool law, knew about compulsory school laws. Klicka had gone to Gary North's seminar when he was a college student down in Gary North, if your reader listeners know about this, North was Rush Dooney's son-in-law, married one of Rush Dooney's daughters, and was going to be like the second generation Rush Dooney leader in this patriarchal clan. And then they had a falling out and anything. But Gary North is, anybody who knows about Reconstruction knows, he's a very famous guy and is at least as outspoken as his father-in-law in terms of applying the Bible rigorously.
They call him Scary Gary, from what I understood. He went off to Tyler, Texas, and founded a really diehard Reconstructionist movement, talking about hard money and survivalism and stockpiling guns and weapons, you know, food. And I mean, he was
Chris Klicka went. Klicka went down to Texas to that hotbed environment, picked it up. And brought it back. He had actually gone to a Christian Liberty Academy school when he was a boy. And this made it even more hardcore. So that was the world he lived in. And then when he came into HSLDA, he brought that all with him. So the point is, okay, and here's where I want to go with the HSLDA thing. Homeschool Legal Defense Association is not a self-consciously Reconstructionist organization. But a lot of the lawyers who founded it and who worked for it in the early years were. I didn't mention Doug Phillips. He'd be another person to put up in the mix.
Yeah, Vision Forum.
Yeah, Vision Forum, which is now defunct as a major scandal. But Phillips was, brought up in the Reconstructionist movement. He listened to Rush Dooney tapes when he was a kid in the car, you know.
As you do. I was listening to rock and roll, man. I wasn't listening to Rush Dooney.
His dad was playing Rush Dooney. The point is, there was a lot of that influence in the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Now, let me explain why it's kind of fraught. Most people who are fundamentalists are not post-millennialists. They don't believe that the church is going to conquer the world. They believe that the world is getting worse.
They're
pre-millennialists.
Right. They're waiting for the rapture.
That's right. The whole rapture, all that. So that's what makes this kind of interesting. People who believe that, they believe in premillennial dispensationalism, so they don't believe there's much of a history, much of a future for the United States, because basically they're just waiting on the rapture. But at the same time, they've been hearing all this Rush Dooneyan stuff for long enough, they speak with that accent too. It doesn't make any sense. You know, a committed Calvinist will say, you guys are incoherent. How can you not be a post-millennialist, you know, and do what you do? But that's the source of the activism. It's like this double-mindedness, where fundamentalists know they're going to lose, but they want to win so bad. They want America to be the exception to their own law that the world is going to hell.
It seems like in many ways, the way I see it now, you'd be interested to hear what your response is. These fundamentalist institutions, like, for example, Bob Jones University, BJU Press is a major supplier of homeschooling curriculum. They are a straight fundamentalist. They wouldn't have anything to do with Rush Dooney's sort of post-millennial views and all the rest of it. And yet, as I'm seeing it, they are helping him to achieve his dominion mandate by raising up generations of children, inculcating them with this biblical worldview. And I was going through their website the other day, and I kept coming across I searched for Dominion. I didn't get very many hits. Then I found this search called Creation Mandate.
Okay.
So if you go to BJU Press, suddenly you'll find several articles on the Creation Mandate, which sounds very Rushdunian, very Dominionist, but they don't use the exact same language. You know, so as I see it, they are advancing his vision, even though, as you say, they're not explicitly saying, we got this from Rushdoony.
Yeah, that's interesting, the term Creation Mandate. You know, I teach at an evangelical, or it's not even evangelical, I teach at a Christian college, and that's a very prominent idea at my college, which most fundamentalists would think of as a very liberal college. So the idea of Creation Mandate to me doesn't ring Rushdoonian.
Right.
It rings more kind of mainline Protestant. The idea being that Christ called us to love. I mean, the usual interpretation of the Creation Mandate is we're supposed to care for the creation, for the environment.
It's about stewardship.
It's related to environmentalism.
Right. Yeah, you're not talking about dominionism and taking over the world.
No, we're talking about
instituting biblical law.
And, you know, worried about global warming, for example, something like that. Environmentalism is a prominent theme in my own college, not so much in a fundamentalist context.
But you're no card-carrying Reconstructionist then.
not at Messiah.
So you go, though, with a guy like Ferris. He goes on to found Patrick Henry College. Now, to me, this is a fascinating piece because, as you say, he's not necessarily a card-carrying Rushdoonian Reconstructionist, but I was going through Patrick Henry's website the other day. I mean, when I read through, they have a book about the history of their college, and I don't know if you've seen it, but it goes through their vision of the school and what it's all about. I mean, the language is straight Dominion theology. We are raising up generations of godly men and women, specifically with a biblical worldview, so they will take leadership positions in society, in the courts, in the political sector. That is their stated vision, and their student body is overwhelmingly made up of homeschool graduates. So it's a pipeline, not just into higher education, but actually on into leadership. Specifically political, legal. A lot of them go on to law school. They have a very high success rate of applicants getting into law schools. So to me, that's another whole piece of this puzzle, surely.
Yeah, that's right. Ferris called it the Joshua generation, which is an important and interesting metaphor, right? Joshua, of course, takes the land of Canaan through battle. It's soft reconstruction. He doesn't actually mean, at least at this point, that he wants his homeschool graduates to, you know, buy a bunch of guns and take over Washington, D.C., literally the way Joshua took over the land of Canaan.
But
in a metaphorical sense, that's what we're doing by infiltrating the key domains of political power. Yeah. That's Ferris's vision all along. Now, if you know much about Patrick Henry College, and this is an important thing we need to understand about this whole movement, a lot of people who look at this from the outside start to think, oh, man, this is really scary. But if you look at what's actually happening on the ground, it's a lot less scary than you think for a couple of reasons. Reason number one, as you saw with North and Rushdoony, as we've already mentioned, these movements have a tendency towards infighting and splitting and breaking up and getting angry with one another. And they exert a lot of energy disagreeing with one another. And if you follow the history of Patrick Henry College, the early years were brutal. Ferris is a very strong-willed leader. Anytime anyone would challenge him, he would tend to fire them or get angry. And so most of the vast majority of the faculty in the first few years of Patrick Henry either were fired or left. They couldn't get accredited, and they still haven't gotten accredited by a real reputable body. They're accredited by a lesser known body that usually accredits Bible colleges. But they have had tremendous success, especially in debate. And like, as you say, with placement, their graduates and law schools. So point number one, there's a lot of infighting. And so this movement is not this well-organized cabal that liberals sometimes portray them as being. Point number two is watch the second generation. We've already seen it. I don't know if in the more recent version of my book, I talk about this. I have a whole section called The Revolt of the Joshua Generation. A lot of those second generation homeschool kids who were trained and groomed to be these transformative Christian leaders, they have turned their back on this movement. A lot of them won't even mention if they're in Washington, they don't want people to know that they went to Patrick Henry College. And it's these graduates of homeschooling who are now leading the charge for increasing the regulations on homeschooling, because a lot of them feel like they didn't get a very good education. Mm-hmm. They're concerned about a lot of the abuses that have happened in the movement and stuff like that. They know from the inside what went on. So it's not at all what Ferris originally intended it to be. The more recent incarnation of the college is a lot more irenic than it was at its founding. And that will continue. It will go mainstream or else it won't survive.
Yeah, I was looking through the Joshua Generation website the other day, and that was another area of concern that I had going along with this thing about Patrick Henry College. He's saying, look, let's get the kids that are currently in homeschool, let's get them involved in Patrick Henry's curriculum. He's got stuff they can, courses they can take, summer camps they can go to. They can act, they've actually been involved in something like, the website said, over 150 political campaigns across America in different states. These are homeschool kids now. They've got literally pounding the pavement, handing out flyers, working in polling booths and all the rest of it, pushing generally Republican, more conservative.
That's correct. Yeah, they're free labor from the Republican Party. Yeah. That's what it is.
And
yeah.
then,
see,
obviously...
Like I said, those kids, they know this. And they go to debate, and they get good at that. They're taught how to think critically.
Sure.
And once they turn that attention to their own upbringing, the results are often not what their parents expected, not what Patrick Henry wanted them to conclude.
Quite shocking. Now, you mentioned abuses, too. Now, we didn't talk about this, but you mentioned Bill Gothard. He's got connections to the biblical patriarchy movement. What can you say about the whole Quiverful movement? Because, of course, that's another aspect of this homeschooling thing. Like you said, Christian families tend to have these huge families, lots of kids. A lot of that plays into this Quiverful theology.
Yeah, okay, let me moderate what you just said. Christian families tend to have these huge families. Some of them do.
Yeah, I mean, homeschooling families.
Yeah, yeah, the ones that are well-known, like you know,
the Duggars,
a bunch of kids, right? But that's not your typical homeschooler. And then we need to always remember that. What we're talking about when we're focusing on these Quiverful families, these Reconstructionists, we're not talking about the majority. We're not talking about the mainstream homeschoolers.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there is a significant minority of homeschooling families who, again, going back to my fundamental thing I started with, these are people who believe in the Bible. They want to take that seriously. The Bible says, you know, blessed is the man who has his quiver full of children are a blessing from the sons, or a blessing from the Lord. Blessed is the man who has his quiver full of them, right?
Yep.
That's
You're
what you want to do.
Release them out into the society. And
right. We want to talk about that creation mandate, you know, be fruitful and multiply, right? Subdue the earth. Have lots and lots of children because that's what God told you to do. So the kind of prohibition against birth control that used to not be a thing, well, it was a big thing in the early 20th century, and then Protestants kind of accommodated themselves to birth control. The Catholic Church officially never did. But Protestants have increasingly began to, conservative Protestants have begun to frown on birth control. The Pharisees are a good example of that. They didn't believe in birth control, influenced largely by Bill Gothard on that score.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been the trend among these very, very conservative families.
Mm-hmm. We know there are a lot of unreported abuses and all that. So that's another aspect. In fact, I'm going to be speaking to someone who's an expert on, she came out of the Quiverful movement. We've been in dialogue with her. So that's a whole nother podcast episode to talk about, you know, the Mike and Debbie Pearls of the world and all those kind of people. I mean, there's some really extreme stuff. All right. I got one last question for you. If you got a couple more minutes, what do you see as the future of Christian homeschooling specifically?
Yeah.
I mean, we talk about connections to the religious right and, you know, some of the infighting and things that go on. Where is this thing going?
I really don't know. It's so fascinating to watch. Here's what I'm seeing. If you look at major, like all the polling data from the Pew Center and Barna survey and Gallup, every survey that surveys the American population sees, especially since this stuff that we're talking about has become popular, a massive decline in religious participation in America. The young in America today are by far, I mean, way, way, way less religious than their predecessors have been. We have the United States of America is growing increasingly secular. It's just unavoidable to see that. Every old person that dies and young person that replaces them is transforming the balance. And more and more Americans do not go to church, they're not connected to formal religion and support. That's what's happening in the mainstream. What's happening in our Christian churches? Well, the Catholic Church, were it not for immigration, would be in complete decline. But thanks to immigration, it's kind of barely holding its own.
Mm-hmm.
Evangelical Protestantism, what we've been talking about this whole time. It seemed like in the 90s, you know, and then, you know, when George W. Bush gets elected, it seemed like this was like it's the one great exception. And there was a lot of triumphalism among conservatives looking at the liberal mainline and seeing how those mainline churches were all declining and the conservatives were doing great. Well, now the conservative churches are declining as well. So even though we're seeing all this stuff that we've been talking about this whole time, the demographic trends in America do not suggest that the future is with Reconstruction. All right, so that's point number one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I don't know. But then point number two, in what's been going on in our national politics over the last 3.5 years, the man who now is the figurehead of conservative Republicanism, how you can connect him to the themes of patriarchal leadership, biblical values, return to Puritanism. I mean, it's, you know, so were I...
They're doing it, though.
I don't know. Where, you know, the
David
best
Barton's
you got,
doing it.
Yeah, I mean, you hear a lot of Pentecostals use the analogy with Cyrus the Persian. You know, Trump is like King Cyrus. He's a friend, even though he's not of us. But it seems to me that the fallout from all of this is even more the same thing we saw in the 1970s. What you had in the 1950s, you had a whole lot of Americans going to church. There was like this core, this moderate, you know, the Sunday morning Christians, right?
The year of the evangelicals, 1976.
Yeah, they're gone now. And the reason they're gone is because they got frustrated in the 70s and 80s with the, what they took to be the kind of religious bigotry, the conservatism so Christianity got associated with right-wing extremism, you know, racism associated with antagonism towards women's rights, towards gays, that sort of thing. Well, that has increased all the more in the current climate. So I have no idea where homeschooling is going to go in terms of this kind of homeschooling. I think there's a big future for homeschooling, but I don't know in terms of what percentage of that future is going to be this real conservative, purposeful type homeschooling. I just don't know.
To me, it is ironic that, as you say, there's this groundswell of evangelical support for Donald Trump. In their view, a lot of these like Seven Mountains Mandate, Dominion theologians, and people like Paula White, Lance Wall now, there's a whole list of names that could go down that line. They think they're achieving dominion. That's what they're saying. They're saying Trump is helping us achieve dominion.
But actually, they got the power.
Yeah, it's going to have the
now.
Yeah, they've got the power. They've got an evangelical advisory board and everything else. But it's having a huge backlash. So when this whole thing, when all the dust settles, to me, they're going to be far worse off
in
terms of pure
way.
Numbers than anything else, and influence and everything else. People are disgusted by a lot of what they see.
The way of saying is, what is it profit to gain the world and lose your soul?
Exactly. Thank you so much, man. I've really appreciated talking to you. Your book is Homeschool in American History. How can people find your book, and how can they get a hold of you if they want to get a hold of you?
Sure. Well, you could email me at mgaither.messiah.edu, and my book is, like every book, it's available on Amazon.
Fine books are sold.
The original edition was 2008, and I revised it in 2017. With I revised the whole thing, but I wrote a really important last chapter, bringing the movement up to date, talking about a lot of scandals and some of the stuff we were just talking about just now.
So definitely go out and get the book. Thank you so much, Dr. Gaither. I've absolutely enjoyed spending, in my case, the evening with you. In your case, it's the middle of the day. Thank you so much. I've really appreciated chatting with you.
My pleasure. Enjoy it.